final case for argument this morning is 15-3233, Howard v. Air Force. Mr. White, whenever you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Marshall D. White, and I represent Petitioner Sherman Howard in an appeal from a final decision of the Merit System Protection Board. In addition to the conceded error by the agency on appeal, the Board's final decision denying Mr. Howard's motion for attorney fees
let me interrupt right there so that I can get something straight that's not entirely straight. There's a concession that the Board erred, so this matter is going to go back to the Board one way or the other, correct? With respect to the 4 hours that we're looking at?
I guess, looking at it from that limited basis, that's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Or in theory, the government could just write you a check.
That's exactly right also, Your Honor. So I wasn't going to just wholeheartedly...
And that's what you're hoping for.
That would be very appreciated. But wishful thinking is wishful thinking. But nevertheless, the Board's final decision denying in part Mr. Howard's motion for attorney fees should be reversed for the following reasons. The administrative judge did not provide a legally sufficient factual basis for reducing 56 hours from the hours claimed. The agency made no such objection to counsel's experience or the time counsel expended filing submissions with the board.
Well, what's your real beef with the district court, with the administrative judge? That she read a 14-page submission and she knew your experience and what your hourly rate was, and she looked at this and said, there is no way that this took 56 hours to prepare, and she cut it down to whatever she cut it down to. Is that what we're here about?
No, I think it's the other side of that, is that she did not look at the issues involved in the agency's compliance notice. You have to remember that there were eight issues of non-compliance raised. This is going to the merits of the underlying litigation, but there are eight issues of non-compliance raised in the petition for enforcement, and they were significant. And I don't think when she went to assess the reasonableness of the attorney fees, she did not look at or carry forward her analysis in making a determination that Mr. Howard was a prevailing party. She, in her analysis that Mr. Howard was a prevailing party, she acknowledged the substantial errors that the agency or the government made in calculating his back pay award. But she didn't carry that forward as required under Hensley versus Eckhart, the seminal Supreme Court case on attorney fees. You're supposed to make a determination as to whether the attorney fees are reasonable in relation to the relief sought. And if they are substantial, that is, if the relief obtained is substantial in a case where the claims are interrelated, which there is no dispute here that all the claims of noncompliance are interrelated, they stem from the same set of transactional facts asserted in the agency's compliance notice, then under Hensley, the fee applicant should receive the full award.
I don't know. I'm not clear. I mean, maybe there are just too many issues and too many things that we're fighting over in this case, so it's hard for me to focus. I mean, one thing she did, and my question to you is this what you're talking about, where she did the analysis with regard to all of the submissions for attorney's fees, and then at the end she said, and by the way, you really only won on the compliance issues. You didn't win on anything you spent on the reviewing it and reconsideration, so I'm just going to chop those fees off. Is that what you're arguing about here?
No, I think what we're reviewing, what Mr. Howard has asked the court to review is the analysis that the administrative judge undertook or did not undertake with respect to the time counsel reasonably expended in pursuing the relief
Isn't a judge allowed to review that?
I mean, yeah,
you don't have the right to just give them your time card and say, pay me. That's your job.
I totally understand that. But since we're this morning, I've heard it mentioned a couple times about jurists, and I think we have another up-and-coming jurist with respect to Justice Kagan on the Supreme Court, and she indicated, I believe, in a case styled Fox versus Vice, a 2011 case, where a trial judge has discretion, but only when he calls a game by the right rules. So while the judge has discretion, which I acknowledge, that discretion is not unlimited. And the
Supreme Court, of course, we can all agree to that. What are the rules that she violated?
Going back to my original claim of error, under this court's holding in Kronbecker versus the Merit System Protection Board, as well as Wilson versus Department of Health and Human Services, the judge's basis for reducing 56 hours from the 160 hours claimed was not legally sufficient under the court's holding.
Is that because what the judge said when the reduction of 56 hours took place? It says, I look at this and I'm basing this on word count or page count. And that was her analysis. 56 hours, 14 pages, that's only 56 hours. What she did not do is analyze what it took, the amount of issues that it took, the things that Judge Prost is talking about. She doesn't cite that and just says, page count, hours. Is there any rule that you know of where attorney's fees are based solely on page count?
Absolutely not. In fact, this court rejected that. A similar argument in Nikhil versus the Department of Transportation, which is another case cited in the brief, in our brief, this court rejected that notion, and I cited another district court case that really wholeheartedly rejected that type of analysis.
Right now, we're talking about the PFR, petition for review.
No, we're overall. I think we're overall.
Yeah, but I mean, right now we're talking about the one finding where the judge below said, "I don't think this 14-page document." 50 hours of work, or is reasonable to bill 50 hours of work to this 14-page document. Was that document the petition for review?
No, it was not.
Which document was it?
That was the original petition for enforcement.
Petition for enforcement.
Right, which I think goes to Judge Rayner's point, which raised all of the legitimate claims. You got 8 different claims of noncompliance here. We're talking over $100,000 worth of relief. I mean, this was not a case where the agency did nothing. This court has cited to a couple of different attorney fee cases where the agency didn't do anything before the date of compliance. This was a case where...
On the claims that you did not prevail on, right, when you appealed last time and the court ultimately determined the board below, isn't it true that case law says that a judge in assessing attorney's fees can do an assessment on what was the prevailing party's proportionate level of success in the case? So therefore, for those claims the party did prevail on, we'll focus there on trying to assess what the reasonable fees ought to be. But for the other claims in the case that the party did not prevail on, then a judge has the discretion to deny attorney's fees for those claims. Is that fair to say?
That is fair to say. And that's
part of the analysis here. In fact, it's a significant part of the fee amount that you still want more on. Isn't that right? The petition for review, I guess, is the portion of your case that ultimately went up, got denied, and then the denial was affirmed. And so the judge concluded that anything related to your petition for review didn't merit getting attorney's fees.
Yes or no?
Are you understanding it correctly?
Not quite, Your Honor. Yes and no with respect to that. No, because she actually, in her original or in her analysis of the reasonable hours expended, she actually awarded Mr. Howard 25 hours for the petition for review. So, but then after she, and this goes to the heart of this court's opinion in Bywaters versus United States, after she had determined that Mr. Howard reasonably expended 25 hours on the petition for review, that did go up to this court and was affirmed on appeal. She thereafter excluded those hours that she had already included in the Lodestar calculation. That is a clear error under the court's holding in Bywaters. That's just a clear error. Now,
Bywaters says, that judges that have to figure out how to calculate attorney's fees can take into account you know, the claims that were won on, the claims that were not won on, and devote and concentrate giving it reasonable attorney's fees on just for those claims that were actually won on. I mean, Bywaters takes that into account. And so this particular judge did that too. Now, I understand your point, which is she did that analysis after initially coming to some initial reasonable fee amount. But nevertheless, in terms of the overall analysis, she did the sorts of things that Bywaters permits a judge to do, in the sense that you can exclude fees that relate to claims that were denied.
I disagree with that characterization of what the administrative judge did in this case, Your Honor, respectfully. I do not believe the administrative judge looked at the overall results obtained. That is the key. You can't focus in on just a narrow part that you did not succeed on. You're supposed to look at broadly the overall relief. If you read her opinion several times, as I have done, you will not see an analysis of where she looked at the over in the determination of the reasonableness of the attorney fees. She did that in making her determination on the prevailing party determination. But when you look at the reasonableness of the attorney fee, you can't just slice out a little part that the attorney did not prevail. That is exactly what the Supreme Court was talking about.
I don't understand that. I mean, tell me why. I mean, because you said a part of the test under Lodestar is the number of hours reasonably expended. Now, I agree with Judge Chen that she did this as a two-step, and presumably she should have done it as a one-step. But if she had done it as a one-step, why is that not exactly her job? She looked at the PFRs, and she said they were not the prevailing party with respect to this whole thing. So these are not hours reasonably expended by the prevailing party. I'm not going to award you fees on that portion. Is the district court not allowed to do that?
Under Hensley, Your Honor, the district court is supposed to make it an overall or a trial form, whichever, however you want to look at it. It's supposed to make an overall assessment of the relief obtained. It's supposed to be an overall assessment. You don't have to prevail completely to be awarded full attorney fees. That's what Hensley holds.
I guess in theory that might be right, but kind of Bywater, which is a case you rely on, kind of says the opposite, where the criticism there, the reason we reversed the district court judge in that case, was because he got done with his lodestar calculation, and then he comes in and he says, oh, well, wait a minute, I noticed. They only won $1.2 million in this case, and the total amount of attorney's fees I've just awarded is $800,000. That seems crazy to me. I'm going to cut the attorney's fees by 50%. So that's where we reversed the district court, because we said you can't come in after the fact and just use this global idea of how much this case was worth.
Right. Right. I believe Judge Dyke, I believe he wrote the opinion for the
yes.
court. He went through a thorough review of
the criticism was that you can't stand back and do some global assessment about what you think the value of this case was. You've got to do the lodestar calculation.
Yeah, that goes to my point, Your Honor. When the administrative judge was calculating her lodestar figure, she did not do what the district court did not do in Bywaters. That is, you have to consider the overall results obtained in calculating the lodestar figure. This goes to where your argument goes to is Judge, I believe, Plager's dissent in Bywaters. Plager's dissent in Bywaters. That is that you're going to end up with the same number. Well, Judge Dyke and the majority rejected that. That it needs to go back for the administrative judge, or in that case, the district judge, to assess the overall results in determining the lodestar calculation, because otherwise you distort some of the relief that was obtained while focusing in on the limited relief that was not obtained. And that's exactly what's going on here. Again, remember, she had already given Mr. Howard 25 hours for the PFR, reasonably expended, and then she reduced that back out.
Correct. In step one, she awarded 25 hours for the PFR. Then at step two, she says, well, you didn't win at step one, on the PFR. I'm going to reduce you. But step two on Lodestar, and we've clearly said in Hensley, you cannot have a downward adjustment unless there's an exceptional circumstance. And she did not articulate an exceptional circumstance.
She did not do that, Your Honor. She did not do that at all. She did not articulate a reason why counsel's experience required the expenditure of fewer hours than than what was required by the hours counsel claim. There was no, there's no basis for her downward adjustment of the hours expended based on counsel's experience.
Okay, now you're going to a different issue.
Well,
on that issue, isn't it reasonable for a judge to conclude that a lawyer with 10 years of experience ought to be able to do a particular task faster than a lawyer with 6 months of experience?
That needs to be articulated. That wasn't articulated here. I mean, that's the whole key. That's the court's holding in Kronbaker. That's the court's holding in Wilson. That's the court's holding in a couple other cases. You have to articulate what's the nexus between counsel's experience and why he should have been more efficient. Now, going to another decision out of the 11th Circuit, Norman versus the Housing Authority of the City of Montgomery, they specifically rejected that, where you could take counsel's experience and presume that he would be more efficient in getting something done. Well, the court there held that that should have been reflected in the determination of the reasonable hours, not in the determination of the reasonable hourly rate, not in the determination of the hours claim, because to do both, you're going to double count, which is impermissible. You're going to double count counsel's experience, and that's exactly what the administrative judge did in this case. She considered counsel's experience in determining the reasonable hourly rate, and then she subsequently double counted counsel's experience in determining reducing the hours claimed. That's impermissible as well. And those are the main reasons why the board's final decision should be reversed. And again, the government wants to fall back on Hensley, which I think is what we've been discussing quite thoroughly here this morning. Under Hensley, even when there's a determination that a party has achieved limited success, then the administrative judge is required to make a determination whether or not an automatic rejection, which I think is where the court's been going, an automatic rejection of the hours claim for unsuccessful claims, but make a determination whether her lodestar calculation, her resulting lodestar calculation, remains a reasonable fee request in relation to the relief sought. And I submit to this court that it does. I mean, not only her lodestar calculation was $27,000, which is still about $8,000 more, $9,000 more than what she awarded, but I think the original lodestar amount that Mr. Howard requested was reasonable in relation to the relief obtained.
Okay. We've exceeded your time. We'll restore 2 minutes of
rebuttal. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, the government respectfully requests that the MSPB's decision be affirmed in its entirety, except for the 1,200.
Can you speak up?
I apologize.
Move that mic up a little bit.
Except for the $1,200 that the government concedes was not supported by substantial evidence in the record.
Is the government going to write a check on that money, or are we going to have to go back and litigate?
Your Honor, I believe procedurally what would need to happen is the MSPB would just need to issue a decision saying $1,200 should be paid to the petitioner.
We don't want to have to deal with another attorney's fees petition.
Understood, Your Honor. Government feels the same
way. What you're saying is correct, then isn't the petitioner entitled to additional attorney's fees to force you to disgorge the check? I mean, you force him to come up here, and now you're telling us, yes, he deserves a check, but he's got to go down and relitigate before the board, and then the board's got to say where he's entitled to the money.
Your Honor, I understand attorney's fees associated with this appeal would fall under EJIA, and I believe the agency's position in this case has been substantially justified. The agency did not argue for the specific reduction of the 4 hours at issue. The administrative judge made that reduction on her own. In response to the petitioner's brief on appeal, the government conceded that point because the government understood that based on the reason given by the administrative judge for that particular 4 hour reduction on the attorney fee petition, it was not supported by substantial evidence in the record.
Can we move to what I think is, although we covered a lot of territory with your friend, but the heart of it, at least for me, I think, is the fact that this judge seems to have done a lodestar, which accounted for the PFR reasonable attorney's fees, and then have done a step two where she chopped off those fees. One, is that the way you understand what she did? Two, why is that consistent with Bywater that seems to say that all of those calculations have to go in the lodestar? And three, was it harmless error because she was absolutely right that she doesn't have to award fees for that portion of the cost, for the that portion of the case where he lost?
Yes, Your Honor, I do believe that's what she did. She did make a separate reduction for the results obtained in the second stage. It is consistent with Bywaters. Bywaters does not say...
But do you agree that as a technical matter, she technically did something wrong? There are inconsistent with Bywaters when Bywaters says the lodestar calculation is the last calculation. And what she did, plainly, words say it, she calculated a lodestar, quote unquote, and then she adjusted the lodestar downward, which was the step two analysis she did. So as a technical matter, what she did may not have been. Do you agree that's not consistent with Bywaters, although you could nevertheless still make an argument that as a practical matter, it's still the same analysis?
I do not agree that that second stage was prohibited or precluded by Bywaters. I believe what Bywaters says is that if the results obtained, if the calculation of the results obtained is subsumed in the lodestar calculation, then there's no reason for a second reduction. And keep in mind the facts of those cases. They come out of the facts of cases where there's a bulk percentage multiplier in the second stage. For instance, Bywaters was, as Chief Judge Prost pointed out, was a 50% reduction. The Purdue case that Bywaters relies on was a 75% adjustment. And what the Supreme Court has said and what this court has said is that that undermines the credibility of the lodestar. It was not a calculation like it was done in this case on a line item by line item basis for only unsuccessful issues. And to get real quick back to Judge Prost's third question, Your Honor, you are correct that it would not make a difference whether the calculation, the 32-hour reduction, was done in Stage 1 or Stage 2. And one more thing on the Bywaters issue.
The question is it permissible? I mean, your friend says that notwithstanding that he may have lost on certain of his claims, that she's supposed to look at the totality of the litigation in terms of winners and losers and not supposed to just say, well, he lost on these two claims, so let's see the amount of time.
Your Honor, it is permissible. And to the Bywaters point real quick, after Bywaters, this court in Wagner, which was a 2013 case, it followed the same two-step approach. It said that after the calculation of the lodestar, you then move on to an adjustment for the results obtained. And Driscoll, which is the MSPB decision that we cited that falls under Hensley, which is still good law, dealt with the more specific factual issue, which is when you have line item by line items reductions for specific issues. Here, the other thing that is important to note is that the petition for enforcement itself had a combination of successful and unsuccessful issues. The administrative judge made no reductions based on that filing, which combined both successful and unsuccessful issues.
Right, but then, so she finishes her lodestar calculation, and then she says, and now we're going to chop off the portions of that that weren't expended for a winning argument, right?
For winning claims, Your Honor, and it's different than the situation in which a defendant may raise multiple affirmative defenses, and an attorney says, well, you expended all these resources.
So are you saying, I mean, Bywater says repeatedly, we're talking and they have concerns with the amount involved and the results obtained.
Correct.
Is that not what you think what she did for the PFR? Does that not fall under that category?
With respect to the second reduction that she made for the PFR, right, the 25-0,
yeah,
that is a reduction for the results obtained.
Okay, and Bywater says, later cases have made clear that while the amount involved and results obtained remains a factor to be considered in determining a reasonable attorney's fees, it cannot be a basis for reducing the lodestar figure where it could have been taken into account in calculating the lodestar figure. Isn't that precisely the mistake that she made? She did the lodestar without considering it, and then she whacks the lodestar afterwards, right?
No, Your Honor, I don't think that is precisely the mistake she made. I don't believe it's a mistake, and I think the Petitioner's counsel referenced the 35 hours to the PFR, and he said she made two separate reductions. The lodestar reduction, the reasonable hours expended, it was clear what she did, and it's, I believe, clear under the case law that you're looking at the reasonableness of hours expended without looking at the results. So what she did was precisely what she was supposed to do, which is first take a look at the filing itself and see whether the hours expended were reasonable. And she made one reduction. She reduced that from 35 to 25. And then she reduced it all on the results obtained. Right. I believe that's permissible.
That seems to me to just be contrary to the language that Chief Judge Prost read out of Bywaters. I mean, Bywaters is pretty clear that if you're going to make a downward adjustment to a lodestar figure, it's rare. And only in rare and exceptional circumstances. Then it goes on and says that the very factors involved here, they can be considered, but it cannot be the basis for reducing. And in this case, it's exactly the basis for reducing. It's not one of many considerations. It's the exact reason why she reduced the lodestar figure. Isn't that error?
I don't believe it is. Your Honor, again, if you look at Bywaters, I believe Bywaters is talking about when it could have been subsumed in the reasonableness of attorney's fees. Bywaters was a case where there was a settlement. I believe it was a civil rights.
We know what that's case about. I don't understand what your answer to Judge Reyna's question and to mine, frankly. Do you acknowledge that what she did here is she did the lodestar calculation where she didn't account for the fact that the PFR stuff shouldn't have been included. So she gets her lodestar, and then she takes a reduction on the lodestar as step two.
Right? Yes, Your Honor.
And why is that? I mean, is the standard not under Bywater? If you're going to do that, it has to be exceptional?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe the exceptionalness, the rare circumstances, that is still the law as I understand it. It comes out of these cases with the percentage multipliers. I believe if
your theory of the case is that this is an exceptional case, that this is one of the rare circumstances where it's totally okay to reduce the lodestar figure after the lodestar has been calculated?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe it's exceptional in the instance it would be akin to a plaintiff having multiple claims. If this were a regular litigation, plaintiff having multiple claims, plaintiff winning on one claim, losing on the other, filing a motion for reconsideration on the losing claim, let's say at summary judgment or whatever it may be, and then the judge simply knocking out the claims on the motion for reconsideration, which weren't successful. Again, here, when there was a combination of the successful...
Why is that rare? I mean, that happens in every case. In every case, the judge is looking at the processes, at the paces that the parties went through. And these petitions for review is one of them. It's not rare.
I think it's rare that a petitioner is seeking fees for only unsuccessful issues that
were... That's different. Now you're talking about something different. Now you're talking about the rarity of the allegations of a petitioner, really? That's not Hensley.
Your Honor, I do believe this is... I believe it falls under a rare case. It's a rare case in which it's...
Let me ask you this question then. Another adjustment that was made was a reduction of 56 hours over 160. And it is... first, let's see if the circumstances she did that, if we can agree on that. Because I don't agree with you on what the exchange we just had before. Let's check this one out. All right. So she reduced 56 out of 160 hours on the basis of page count. Is that correct?
I don't believe that was the basis for a reduction. I believe she gave two bases for her reduction.
Did she make any reduction on the basis of page count?
She made one reference to page count.
Then that's the one I'm talking about.
Okay.
So she did make a reduction on the basis of page count. Is that permissible?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. The only cases cited by petitioner...
How can you determine the amount of labor, the amount of work that on the basis of page count? Suppose I ask you, should I go bomb my neighbor? and you go out and you hire experts and you hire bomb technicians and explosive experts and sniffing dogs and everything, and you come back and you hand me, after weeks of this type of work, you hand me a document that says no. It might just say that, well, gee, this isn't worth much. I'll give you a dollar.
No, Your Honor, I don't believe you can. I agree with Your Honor that a reduction simply based on page count is somewhat trivial, but that is not what the court did.
Not trivial. Is it error?
I don't believe, Your Honor, I don't believe specifically it's error. I don't believe the petitioner has cited any cases that say it's error. He cites two cases, the Nikhil case and the Nikhil case.
Well, if he's saying it's error in this case, cite me cases where he's wrong. That this court has said that it's permissible for an administrative law judge to reduce hours on the basis of page count alone.
I'm not aware of a case that says specifically you can cite a page number, and that is fine. I do know many district court cases do it. We've cited three. The government cited three in its response brief, and in the reply, the petitioner did not distinguish those cases or address those cases. So while the two cases that petitioner cited for the page count argument are both cases in which a court tried to take one brief and divide between successful and unsuccessful issues in the same brief. Here, when the court had that opportunity to do that in the petition for enforcement itself, she did not do that. She did not make any reductions based on page counts devoted to unsuccessful issues.
No, but all she said was, I mean, am I missing something? She says, still, I find that 50, even though the case was required substantial analysis, was complex, blah, 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 still, I find that 50 hours for preparing and filing a PFE that amounted to just 14 pages was not reasonable given Mr. White's experience.
Yes, Your Honor. She says
that. In the cases that you cite that relied on page numbers, was the analysis and the justification as thin as that?
Frankly, it wasn't that more detailed. I don't believe it was any more detailed. Two points, though, on that. One, with respect to the page count reduction, when we look at only the reduction, the 50 hours to the 20 hours, what we don't look at is the 9 out of 14 entries that she didn't reduce. For instance, there was one entry, 10 hours, that was reviewing the agency's compliance before the PFE was filed.
Well, that's not
and she didn't
us
cut
on
that.
Appeal. I mean, I don't understand. That's not an issue before us. You haven't filed a counterclaim on that. It's just,
but
why
should
we be looking at those questions?
Because it goes to, when you look at, I believe it goes to Judge Reyna's hypothetical. When you're looking at just the brief itself and you're looking at just the page number, whether that's permissible or whether that's trivial and whether that really goes to what took to what the petitioner's counsel had to do to prepare that particular document, the review area. And I see that the light is on with just one final thought. Any issues between any problems with distinguishing time between clerical tasks or other tasks is a problem of the petitioner's own making. On PA 40 of the record, petitioner filed one page itemized spreadsheet. The government objected to that and said that there were block billings, and petitioner addressed two sentences on PA 117 in his reply.
Did the district, did the administrative judge refer to any, the deficiency in his pleading? Did he rely on that?
I believe that's inherently in the fact that tasks were both for preparation and filing of documents. That's two sides of the same coin, if you will.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you.
I'll give you 2 minutes of rebuttal if you need it, but if you're
yes, just a couple of issues I'd like to address. Thank you very much. Your Honor, I think the last point opposing counsel was raising, there is no finding of inadequate documentation with respect to counsel's motion for attorney fees. I think that's what he's raising with respect to saying it's just one page where I listed out. There was no finding with respect to inadequate documentation. He raised another issue with respect to a later case, I believe it was Style Wagner versus Shinseki, which came after Bywaters. If there's any issue with respect to which case is controlling, it's Bywaters because it preceded Wagner. So, which I don't believe there's any conflict, but to the extent there is, Bywaters controls.
Was Wagner presidential opinion?
It was a presidential opinion, but he cited it in his argument just now. So I think the court has, if this case, to your, I think your discussion, Judge Moran, if this case is an exception, the exception swallows the rule in Bywaters. I mean, this case is not an exceptional case at all. And
getting back to the 14-page document inquiry, I'm looking here at the appendix of page 11. I see that the judge is taking into account your level of experience, the relative complexity of the issues, and the length of the document, which is 14 pages. What more would you want the judge to say? Let's say, hypothetically, we remanded it back and say, that's not enough, you need to do more. What more would actually be sufficient in your own eyes in terms of adequately substantiating the determination that there were too many hours?
Right.
Just the analysis. I mean, on the merits, obviously, you feel differently, but what is the appropriate level of analysis that's required when we're doing these line-by-line itemizations?
Well, I mean, if hypothetically speaking, Your Honor, she could say this is Mr. White's 10th petition for enforcement. I mean, given if she's going to get into experience, if she was, I mean, this is Mr. White's 10th petition for enforcement. By now, he knows how to address all the issues in a petition for enforcement. This is, this 14 pages, given Mr. White's experience, I don't believe it took 50 hours. She just doesn't have that background, frankly. And that's why this is legally insufficient under the court's holding in Kronbaker. I mean, what she said here on page 11, if you take a look at the court's holding in Kronbaker, is almost verbatim, and the court rejected it out of hand. And she did that for 56 hours, across the board, task by task. And that was error. That was error. So while it may not change, she is required to articulate a reason for those reductions that meets the legally sufficient standard set out in Hensley. A clear and concise explanation of the reasons for the fee award. Let's see what else I want.
So just to dig down a little deep, because I'm having the same question, I can't see what more she would have said under the circumstances. This is a line item. I mean, some of these attorney's fees cases are voluminous, and we don't want to set a standard that a district court judge has to write a 300-page opinion in order to satisfy us that she's got sufficient reasoning. So aside from the fact that you're experienced, I don't think you would dispute that. She says, based on his experience, she obviously read the document, and she said, based on your experience, the number of cases you had, I don't think it was reasonable.
Well,
to charge this much money. I'm really not hearing from you on what more she could say to give you a fulsome analysis.
Well, first of all, I don't think that she should have reduced them. I guess that's on the merits, goes to Judge Chin's point. I don't think she should have reduced them on the merits. So I can't come up with an answer why she should reduce them.
But
I mean,
what would
I really
she have to say if she wanted to reduce it? That's my question.
I'm sorry? I'm not trying to be judgmental to that extent, but I mean, she reduced the hours. She came up with this conclusory reason for doing it. It just doesn't meet the standard. Now, I can't articulate a reason that would meet the sufficiency standard when I obviously want the fee. I have a self-interest. Why would I articulate a reason for her to meet the standard?
No, but then you're giving us, then we're shooting in a dark room here.
Well, she was the one.
We need to know.
We're not going to reverse her unless we know what.
At a minimum, what's your conception of what is an adequate basis for reducing fees for this particular line item? What could she have said, she should have said, that she did not say to justify?
Well, I think with respect to the limited discretion, unless there was some duplication of effort, some padding, which is obviously not a finding in this case, she doesn't have any discretion to reduce those hours. There's no discretion there. So again, you're asking
me. So what if you had charged 216 hours for a 14-page PFO?
I think that goes to some comments about maybe being overly lawyered, cases being overly lawyered. I think this court has rejected cases like that. You just can't make conclusory comments that the case was over lawyered and not award fees.
Earlier you had mentioned the lack of a nexus, and here. When you look at the amount of time spent on a particular matter, and there's a general standard in the legal profession with respect to that amount of time, et cetera, I don't know if there is the same type of standard with respect to page count. We have very experienced lawyers that appear before our court, and they'll very easily produce a 100-page document if you let them, and others who can say the same thing in 5 pages. I have not come across a nexus, and I don't see any case that establishes that there is such a nexus between page count and the expertise of the attorney. And that's something that perhaps an LAJ can put in her analysis when she's making these type of determinations.
I think you're correct, Your Honor, and I think the great weight of authority, the authority that I cited in my brief, and in respect to the authority he cited in his brief with regard to page count, is obviously not controllable.
Let me ask you this last question. So the money that on the $1,800?
The 4 hours, I think. You're talking about the four yes. hours? I think that's $1,200, Your Honor.
Okay, and there's been an agreement, there's the concession of the government that money is owed you?
Only on appeal, and I think you raised that point. I had to write a brief to obviously
that concession's get this. Only come up on appeal?
Right.
Well, I would hope that the government issue this check immediately. We're dealing with our men and women in service on these type of issues, and once the government determines that somebody is rightfully due a certain sum, I think they should be given that sum and not have to go back down to the board and plead to the board and have the board order you to make that type of an issuance.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
That concludes the argument. Thank both sides. The case is submitted. That concludes our proceedings for this morning.
All rise.